It was nearly midnight on September 4th, 1910, in Peoria, Illinois, when the dark sky above the train yard opened and a pelting rain suddenly poured down. Surprised, the night watchman ran to a boxcar for shelter. That decision saved his life. He was safely inside when the bomb exploded. It was a clock bomb, rather crudely made, but fueled by 10 gallons of nitroglycerin. It had been placed under a nearby railway car transporting an 80-ton girder. The force of the blast knocked the watchman to the boxcar's wooden floor. Outside, the girder shot high into the sky. Shards of metal showered down, spears falling like iron lightning bolts amid the hard, hammering rain. Within hours, the president of the McClintock Marshall Iron Works, the company that had fabricated the girder for a bridge being built across the Illinois River, hired the Burns Detective Agency to investigate the blast. A local Burns operative left his bed and hurried to the scene. Under a freight car carrying a second huge girder, he discovered a clock bomb that had failed to explode. The battery had lost its voltage. The clock had also been set for 11 hours and 59 minutes and 59 seconds. This would have allowed sufficient time for any escape. The culprits would be long gone and, he anticipated, difficult to trace. Outside the yard, he found an empty nitroglycerin can and a small, neatly piled hill of sawdust. He brought the can and the unexploded bomb to the attention of the Peoria police captain at the scene. The captain glanced at the device, shook his head in a gesture of disgust at the criminals who had planted it, and then walked off to interview the night watchman. Later, after the police had left, the Burns man retrieved the can and the bomb. He also gathered up the sawdust particles. He put all the evidence, the nitroglycerin can, the unexploded bomb, and the sawdust, into a large box and sent it to the agency's headquarters in Chicago. For weeks, the box sat on a shelf in the evidence room, ignored and unopened. It was only after the events in Los Angeles that Billy Burns began to suspect its significance. Chapter 2. California, here we come. Over the hills and across the valleys of America, from the icy wind-swept prairies and the snow-bound farmlands of the Midwest, people flocked to Los Angeles. As the 20th century began, the city's Chamber of Commerce spread the word that sunshine would cure any illness, that ripe oranges hung from trees ready for the taking, and that fortunes could be made buying and selling parcels of land. The California dream captured people's imagination, and day after day, Southern Pacific and Santa Fe Railroad cars filled with newcomers arrived at the Los Angeles station. In just a generation, this Pueblo village, dozing in the sunshine, began to take shape as a city. By 1910, its population approached 900,000, and people were still pouring in. And as the city grew, and its inhabitants prospered, Los Angeles became a battleground. It was a battle that was being fought all across America, in Western mines, in New England mills, in New York sweatshops, in railroad cars traversing the nation. Labor raged against capital. The nation was locked in a class struggle that threatened to erupt into the next civil war. At one non-compromising extreme were unions, such as the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW. They urged direct action. Sabotage, violence, these were acceptable, even necessary, political weapons. The goal was to place the working class in possession of the economic power, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution, without regard to capitalist masters. For these radical unionists, there can be no harmony between employer and employee. In opposition, capitalists formed militant associations. organizations that were empowered by immense wealth, reinforced by private armies of goons, corrupt police, and hired detectives. They were led by men certain that material success was tangible proof of moral superiority. The associations held that profit must be maximized, regardless of the human cost or suffering, and that no union man should be employed. The nation was locked in an intense struggle over its future and over the quality of American life and justice. But nowhere in the country did the opposing armies of unions and employers collide with greater frequency than in Los Angeles. In the first decade of the 20th century, the city had become the bloodiest arena in the Western world for capital and labor. This long-running confrontation was largely provoked by the sentiments, leadership, and intransigence of one belligerent and self-confident individual, Harrison Gray Otis. Otis's was, in its meandering, unpredictable way, a typical California success story. He had come to California in 1880 at the age of 42, with no more specific ambition than to start over in the bright sunshine. He had been a hero in the Civil War, enlisting in his native Ohio as a Union private, and had risen, after 15 battles and several wounds, to the rank of captain. But he had had no success in civilian life. His warrior's temperament had difficulty adjusting to the succession of menial jobs that came his way. Clerk in the Ohio House of Representatives, and then a compositor, later a foreman in the government printing office. In desperation, he found a position as a treasury agent of the Seal Islands in the Bering Sea. With only his wife Eliza for company, he endured a period of detachment and exile. A mountain of a man, with a walrus mustache and a wild goatee, bristling with an instinctive aggressiveness, even his speaking voice a thunderous boom, Otis felt caged, his vitality drained by his life in these bleak, barren islands. He served his 3 years and then headed to Southern California, eager to pursue the vague yet restorative promise in endless blue skies and warm days.